Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today I have the pleasure of introducing Dylan Landis. It's her first time on the show. She's the author of a novel called Rainy Royal. It's published by Soho Press. She has a book of stories called Normal People Don't Live Like This. And if you find that you love the characters in Rainy Royal, you can find out more about them in the book of stories. But I found that Dylan Landis writes stories about disturbed people, young people mainly. They're girls. Sometimes movies call them mean girls. But they didn't seem so much mean to me as terribly, terribly vulnerable and easily touched and hurt. And the method of the writing is to deal in short, sharp shocks. Can you tell me what I might mean by that?
I think what you mean by it is that these are written as stories originally, and so they're very compressed and very distilled. And the short, sharp shocks come one after the other, story by story by story. And there's not a lot of space between them as there might be if I had written it as a novel from the beginning. And these girls, I think of them less as mean girls than as damaged girls, whose job over the course of the novel, if I can speak of it that way, because I did try to weave it together into a novel, is to learn to live with the damage with grace.
And they seem to keep secrets from one another. One of them doesn't want Rainy Royal, who grows up in what might be considered a spectacular townhouse downtown, where her father has, what is his word for them?
Acolytes.
Acolytes, who are gifted musicians. And the acolytes are very interested in Rainy because she's been very developed physically from a very young age. And so she attracts them, and she feels that attracting them is, in a certain sense, a form of security for her. She learns certain ways of licking her lips, of blinking her eyes, of drawing people to her that she doesn't think of as sexual. She thinks of it as alluring.
I would say that's exactly right, that it's a matter of being alluring. It's a matter of being magnetic, that this is a girl who's been deprived of normal parental love and making herself magnetic to what she thinks of as love it's her purpose in life.
Her mother has left, but she's left behind, what is the scent?
Oh.
Tea rose oil?
It's tea rose oil. Yes, she's left behind a little brown vial of tea rose oil that Rainy puts between her toes and on her wrist. And she's convinced in part that it's the scent of tea rose oil that draws her father's best friend into her room at night. She feels guilty and responsible in part for that. But she wants to drive men wild with this scent.
It's not clear about this father's best friend, whose name is Gordy in this book. He happens to be an albino. But he might not be. His eyes are green. He's very pale. His hair is white. And he comes into Rainy's room at night and combs her hair. We're not sure whether he goes farther. It's not told to us. And so these details shiver for us because they might mean more than they're saying. They may not. He gives back rubs too, and Rainey wishes she knew where her back ended and her side began, because she doesn't know how to say no. She doesn't know how to say, no, don't go there. And her teachers at a private school, what is the name of it?
Urban Day.
They're concerned. And I thought I'd ask you to read a section of the book where the teacher seems to know a good deal by now about what's going on in this house. Here's Dylan Landis reading from Rapture and the Fiercest Love.
On Monday, Rainey witnesses the sorrow of Miss Honor Brennan, who wears a crucifix tucked under her clothes. Miss Brennan suggests that they eat lunch together after class at her desk. Revoltingly intimate to see a teacher's lunch, its homemade sandwich and nicked pear. I didn't bring lunch. Rainey holds her pack to her chest and backs away. Miss Brennan dangles a rumpled brown bag and says, I'll share. She has a widow's peak that sculpts her glowing blue-eyed face into a heart. I think you could use a chat. I'm fine. Rainey's hand is on the doorknob. The only thing keeping her in the science lab is curiosity. Yes, I agree you're doing a tremendous job of holding it together, says Miss Brennan. But people are saying things. She touches her crucifix through the starched fabric of her blouse. Sometimes it works loose. Rainey has seen it. I can't believe they're all true, but I'm asking you to stay and talk. She is the prettiest teacher at school. She has to be dating one of the male teachers, right? Oh, for Christ's sake, says Rainey, but she doesn't exactly fling herself out. She wants to hear what people are saying. Please, says Miss Brennan, sit and tell me about your mother, Rainey. I understand she left. Rainey slowly closes the door. She didn't leave. My mother took a year to study Ashtanga Vinyasa Yoga at an ashram in Boulder, Colorado. She went to the library for this one. She goes to the library for everything. Miss Brennan looks at her steadily. When she comes back, she'll be certified to teach it, says Rainey. We talk twice a week. Miss Brennan sucks in her lower lip and nods. Sit down, Rainey. Rainey stays at the door. Your father says she never calls. He didn't make a secret of it at our parent-teacher conference. Please, sit. She calls when he's not home. Rainey scuffs over to a chair and drops her pack on it. Obviously, he doesn't know we talk. We talk about art. She's my mother. Miss Brennan gestures firmly at the chair. You can always leave, she says. Have a pair. Rainey sits tangentially. First, she dislodges her pack. Then she shoves another chair out of the way. She does not have a pair. The teachers who care about you are wondering, says Miss Brennan in the same soft voice, as if she were slowly wrapping Rainey in cashmere, if you need help with your home situation. I don't mean to pry, but she takes a delicate bite of her sandwich, which has a petticoat of lettuce around the edges. Some teachers have heard it's like a commune. The word cult came up. Is it true, Rainey, that your father has a lot of young people living there? Rainey looks at her, amazed. Do people think her mother abandoned her to some cult? It's none of your business, she says. I'm making it my business. Miss Brennan bites deep into her sandwich, and Rainey senses that she cannot, in fact, always leave. My father, she says, runs... It's like a boarding school for brilliant jazz students. I live in a house full of music. She chooses her words carefully. It's very creative, she says. My home is a very nurturing place. Miss Brennan pushes the pear closer to the edge of her desk. Eat, she says. Where do these brilliant jazz students sleep? With Howard, thinks Rainey. It's a 5-story townhouse, she says. We have like a zillion bedrooms. Is that enough, says Miss Brennan. Your father is very charismatic. I've met him. Is there any adult activity going on in that house that might make you uncomfortable? Do you feel safe, Rainey? It's my house. I feel 200% safe. Rainey stands, pushing the chair away. It screeches. People are concerned for you, Rainey.
That was Dylan Landis reading from the second chapter of Rainy Royal, which is called
Rapture and the Fiercest Love.
And there is a language like rapture and the fiercest love that comes through the book. The first chapter also is called Let Her Come Dancing All Afire. There's a language of the imaginative and beating heart that makes things safer for Rainey. If she feels that she's an artist, if she feels that she's a creature of rapture and dance, then she's safe, yes?
Yes, absolutely. She, for instance, seeks the protection of a saint whom she has to go out and research and find for herself. And she finds the existence of Saint Catherine of Bologna, who is both the patron saint against temptation and the patron saint of artists. And through her, Rainey is able to touch the divine in a way and feel protected in the way that someone else might feel protected by the presence of a mother.
Now, many things recur in this book. There's an egg that the art teacher has taught her to. What are they doing with this egg?
This was a very strange high school assignment that I actually had to do in ninth grade, and I have never understood it, and I had to get it out of my system and into a book. It involved making an egg out of clay, letting it harden, and then rubbing it for a very long time, days and days, with the back of a spoon until it glowed. It literally gleamed. It looked like pewter. I don't know the purpose of this assignment, and neither does Rainey, but she takes it very seriously, as she takes all art assignments seriously.
But she is associated with the image of an egg. She, in her laboratory, she takes out a hard-boiled egg and begs her science teacher, it's the same teacher you just heard in the section we read, to let her perform that experiment where an egg falls through a narrow-necked flask. And it's a mesmerizing chapter because the teacher loses complete control while understanding how much Rainey needs to be allowed to have control and yet terrified to see what's happening to her classroom.
Yes.
Why eggs?
Why eggs? Michael, I didn't realize until this moment that the egg repeated. But I think, now that you say it, it's amazing what the subconscious will produce.
Yes, it is.
And I think, now that you say it, that the egg is, it's an amazingly fertile symbol.
Yes.
And Rainey is an amazingly fertile girl.
Yes. And so the book begins to give off mesmerizing, repetitive imagery that gives the reader, I think, an extraplanetary experience. The author is never keying, never pointing. You are picking up traces of sensibility throughout, and it makes for very original prose writing because you're never in safe hands. Rainey is not safe, and the author is finding this shocking prose to create her and her friends and their scams and their wounds to one another and their creation of trust. It's so incredibly, I've never been as deep inside characters like this. And usually on television, in movies, and even in books, we're not given their interior symbology. How did you do that?
I'm not sure how I access it, But I think of the writing, I have a visual image of the writing as something that is floating above the characters because they are not able to articulate these things for themselves. So I have to provide a voice for them. They intuit, they don't articulate. And my job is to articulate for them. So I'm creating a kind of second voice that's not mine, and it's not exactly theirs. It's a voice in the middle. It's almost like what Tina at the end, Tina is Rainey's best friend, calls the inner voice, which is a jazz terminology, a jazz term for a kind of inner melody that occurs in jazz. And I try to write that strand of language that would be what the characters could think if they could articulate what they were intuiting. And it is shocking. They're teenage girls. It's the 1970s. It's New York.
And she doesn't even have all the pieces. And the father is telling Rainey about something that is true for his jazz, that there are ghost notes. And the ghost notes are frequently what are coming out. Some of the teachers intuit the ghost notes, and they're very sensitive, but they can't be as sensitive as they need to be because they have a whole class. Rainey needs the attention, the soul attention, of a person who is not violating her. But the only way to get her attention is to violate her. And so toward the end of the book, we find her with a man that she, a boy really, who she had accused, a French horn player, is it oboist?
Oboist.
Who she had accused, she had to go to her father and accuse the boy of rape, because all of these acolytes in different ways feel free to enter Rainey's room, to lounge on her bed, to borrow her clothes and her earrings. There's that sense of a person whose boundaries have been completely blown.
Well, she does, she makes a real transformation, I think, in the chapter about the rape. She goes up to this boy's room. He's a cornetist, the one who rapes her. And she, her father refuses to help her. He says, an artist can't be a criminal. Have you heard him play cornet? And she goes up to his room and she throws his door open, and you know she's going to give him hell. So that's part of her arc, as she does start to free herself.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from KCRW. I'm talking with Dylan Landis about her book, Rainey Royal. We'll continue after this short break.
I'm Connie Alvarez, producer of Bookworm. Check out our other KCRW programs in the podcast section of iTunes. Shows like DNA, Good Food, The Treatment, Unfictional, and The Business. Or listen on KCRW's smartphone apps. And thanks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Dylan Landis about her new book, Rainey Royal, the story of a young girl tenaciously coming into her own with only her power of survival as her guide. And a good deal of the book involves you, Dylan Landis, the author, weaving spells. I think it's a very, you know, Rainey makes her tapestries, but you're involving these characters in magical, spell-like, poetic activities that can't quite be explained. They buy a wedding cake together, although none of them is getting married. It's three-tiered. A boy comes over to show how the tiers fit together, and with a fabric sock, he fills the sutures between the layers with buttercream. It's such a fascinating image. It's sort of like these three witches have surrounded a cauldron, but to make not a brew, not a hideous toad and newt and eye of frog brew, but a wedding cake. The wedding cake is this huge symbol, but not symbol, of their yearning and their destruction.
For Leah, it's all about the sugar and about the yearning, absolutely. It's about both. She's very much alone in the world because she doesn't know how to reach out to people at all. And the wedding cake is both a symbol of the connection that she can't have because she doesn't know how, and about the sugar that she simply craves all the time.
You've gone beyond the basic writing teacher instruction that you know the characters so well that you would know what they would have for breakfast, or you would know what they have in their room. What aspect of yourself do these characters represent?
I think of Rainey as my alter ego. It's less the characters than the issues that I drew from to power the book. There was a period in my life where I was the girl who got picked on. And then there was a period in my life where I was not the mean girl exactly, but the bad girl. So I've straddled that line, and I've been both of those things. The characters themselves, I really tried not to draw from specific people. There's a great Martin Amis quote about how it's better to base a character on someone you've known for 10 minutes than someone you've known for 10 years, because they're more plastic, they're more malleable. And I had already known Rainey from the previous book, Normal People Don't Live Like This, and I just let her fly.
So she's really a kind of co-spirit, a sister, a familiar.
Yes, very much so. I love her.
Uh-huh.
And she still appears to me. She appears to me now with a baby. So I don't think I'm done with her.
With a baby?
Yes.
Is it a boy or a girl?
I don't know. She hasn't shown me the baby yet.
Now tell me, what is the process by which one of these stories is assembled or concocted or built? There's the image of the wedding cake in tears. There's the image of the tapestry. There's the image of braiding. There's the image of jazz improvisation. How do the stories occur?
I feel like I receive the opening image. I try to meditate and go down into a kind of into the basement, so to speak, from the living room, and wait for an opening image, which is almost always the opening image of the story. Not every time, but usually. So for the first story, Let Her Come Dancing All Afire, it's Rainey in the library looking for her saint. And I write that image, and I never know where it's going to go. I never get the whole story. I never have what you call an idea for a story.
These stories are not written one by one. You go back to them over and over again, don't you?
Yes, I did. I would write a rough draft and send it out to a writer who would serve as a reader for me, as a critiquer, and start a second story, and then go back to the first one when it was returned to me and send the second story out and go back to that. So yes, very much so, I was writing two or even three at once in different stages.
Yeah, because you get the feeling of suspension, you know, that the stories are allowing themselves not to be concluded, and that they are waiting for other images that will be strong enough to compete or complete the initial image. And that these stories are going so far in, not to the completion of the character, but to their dissolute incompletion.
Well, it's interesting. I don't think that they have, I think that they open out at the ends. I think that they state the problem rather than solve a problem at the ends, to paraphrase Chekhov. I don't think that they finish or wrap up.
No, even though at the end, and I'll say it just so people can feel a little bit less worried about poor Rainey, she manages, her grandmother has left the house to her, and she manages to throw her father and all the acolytes out. What she will do now is another question, but she has salvaged her space. She's done it at a terrible cost, but she has taken something for her own. But she exercises the demon. That's what I thought of as the spells, that she was exorcising the demonic presence that was her violation.
Yes, and I think that took a tremendous amount of strength and grace, to use a word I used earlier. And I think it's the power of her art that allows her to do that.
Wow, thank you. I'm so glad we got to talk. I've been talking with Dylan Landis, author of Rainey Royal, published by Soho Press. Thank you, Dylan, for joining me.
Thank you, Michael.
It's been a pleasure. You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Rainey Royal at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to my assistant, Jane Parshall. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Charles Burns is our guest.